Hey, my phone just rang. Slowly, I realize that perhaps this is my delayed call. Now, let me see. Who was I trying to call several hours ago? Did I have several callbacks in place? Why was I making the call? The modern telephone did not happen by accident. It was carefully designed. Someone, more likely a team of people, invented a list of features thought desirable, invented what seemed to them to be plausible ways of controlling the features, and then put it all together. My university, focusing on cost and perhaps dazzled by the features, bought the system, spending millions of dollars on a telephone installation that has proved vastly unpopular and even unworkable. Why did the university buy the system? The purchase took several years of committee work and studies and presentations by competing telephone companies, and piles of documentation and specification. I myself took part, looking at the interaction between the telephone system and the computer networks, ensuring that the two would be compatible and reasonable in price. To my knowledge, nobody ever thought of trying out the telephones in advance. Nobody suggested installing them in a sample office to see whether users' needs would be met or whether users could understand how to operate the phone. The result? Disaster. The main culprit, lack of visibility, was coupled with a secondary culprit, a poor conceptual model. Any money saved on the installation and purchase is quickly disappearing in training costs, missed calls, and frustration. Yet from what I have seen, the competing phone systems would not have been any better. I recently spent 6 months at the Applied Psychology Unit in Cambridge, England. Just before I arrived, the British Telecom Company had installed a new telephone system. It had lots and lots of features. The telephone instrument itself was unremarkable. It was the standard 12-button push-button phone, except that it had an extra key labeled R off to the side. I never did find out what that key did. The telephone system was a standing joke. Nobody could use all the features. One person even started a small research project to record people's confusions. Another person wrote a small expert systems computer program, one of the new toys of the field of artificial intelligence. The program can reason through complex situations. If you wanted to use the phone system, perhaps to make a conference call among three people, you ask the expert system, and it would explain how to do it. So you're on the line with someone, and you need to add a third person to the call. First, turn on your computer. Then, load the expert system. After 3 or 4 minutes, needed for loading the program, type in what you want to accomplish. Eventually, the computer will tell you what to do, if you can remember why you want to do it, and if the person on the other end of the line is still around. But as it happens, using the expert system is a lot easier than reading and understanding the manual provided with the telephone. Refer to Figure 7. Why is that telephone system so hard to understand? Nothing in it is conceptually difficult. Each of the operations is actually quite simple. A few digits to dial, that's all. The telephone doesn't even look complicated. There are only 15 controls, the usual 12 buttons, 10 labeled 0 through 49, pound and star, plus the handset itself, the handset button, and the mysterious R button. All except the R are the everyday parts of a normal modern telephone. Why was the system so difficult? A designer who works for a telephone company told me the following story. I was involved in designing the faceplate of some of those new multifunction phones, some of which have buttons labeled R. The R button is kind of a vestigial feature. It is very hard to remove features of a newly designed product that had existed in an earlier version. It's kind of like physical evolution. If a feature is in the genome, and if that feature is not associated with any negativity, that is, no customers gripe about it, then the feature hangs on for generations. It is interesting that things like the R button are largely determined through examples. Somebody asks, "What is the R button used for?" And the answer is to give an example. You can push the R to access loudspeaker paging. If nobody can think of an example, the feature is dropped. Designers are pretty bright people, however. They can come up with a plausible-sounding example for almost anything. Hence, you get features, many, many features, and these features hang on for a long time. The end result is complex interfaces for essentially simple things. As I pondered this problem, I decided it would make sense to compare the phone system with something that was of equal or greater complexity but easier to use. So let us temporarily leave the difficult telephone system and take a look at my automobile. I bought a car in Europe. When I picked up the new car at the factory, a man from the company sat in the car with me and went over each control, explaining its function. When he had gone through the controls once, I said fine, thanked him, and drove away. That was all the instruction it took. There are 112 controls inside the car. This isn't quite as bad as it sounds. 25 of them are on the radio. Another 7 are the temperature control system. And 11 work the windows and sunroof. The trip computer has 14 buttons, each matched with a specific function. So 4 devices, the radio, temperature controls, windows, and trip computer, have together 57 controls, or just over 50% of the ones available. Why is the automobile, with all its varied functions and numerous controls, so much easier to learn and to use than the telephone system, with its much smaller set of functions and controls? What is good about the design of the car? Things are visible. There are good mappings, natural relationships between the controls and the things controlled. Single controls often have single functions. There is good feedback. The system is understandable. In general, the relationships among the user's intentions, the required actions, and the results are sensible, non-arbitrary, and meaningful. What is bad about the design of the telephone? There is no visible structure. Mappings are arbitrary. There is no rhyme or reason to the relationship between the actions the user must perform and the results to be accomplished. The controls have multiple functions. There isn't good feedback, so the user is never sure whether the desired result has been obtained. The system in general is not understandable. Its capabilities aren't apparent. In general, the relationships among the user's intentions, the required actions, and the results are completely arbitrary. Whenever the number of possible actions exceeds the number of controls, there is apt to be difficulty. The telephone system has 24 functions, yet only 15 controls, none of them labeled for a specific action. In contrast, the trip computer for the car performs 17 functions with 14 controls. With minor exceptions, there is one control for each function. In fact, the controls with more than one function are indeed harder to remember and use. When the number of controls equals the number of functions, each control can be specialized. Each can be labeled. The possible functions are visible, for each corresponds with a control. If the user forgets the functions, the controls serve as reminders. When, as on the telephone, there are more functions than controls, labeling becomes difficult or impossible. There is nothing to remind the user. Functions are invisible, hidden from sight. No wonder the operation becomes mysterious and difficult. The controls for the car are visible, and through their location and mode of operation, bear an intelligent relationship to their action. Visibility acts as a good reminder of what can be done, and allows the control to specify how the action is to be performed. The good relationship between the placement of the control and what it does makes it easy to find the appropriate control for a task. As a result, there is little to remember. The principle of mapping. Mapping is a technical term meaning the relationship between two things. In this case, between the controls and their movements, and the results in the world. Consider the mapping relationships involved in steering a car. To turn the car to the right, one turns the steering wheel clockwise, so that its top moves to the right. The user must identify two mappings here. One of the 112 controls affects the steering, and the steering wheel must be turned in one of two directions. Both are somewhat arbitrary. But the wheel and the clockwise direction are natural choices. Visible, closely related to the desired outcome, and providing immediate feedback. The mapping is easily learned and always remembered. Natural mapping, by which I mean taking advantage of physical analogies and cultural standards, leads to immediate understanding. For example, a designer can use spatial analogy. To move an object up, move the control up. To control an array of lights, arrange the controls in the same pattern as the lights. Some natural mappings are cultural or biological, as in the universal standard that a rising level represents more, a diminishing level less. Similarly, a louder sound can mean a greater amount. Amount and loudness, and weight, line length, and brightness are additive dimensions. Add more to show incremental increases. Note that the logically plausible relationship between musical pitch and amount does not work. Would a higher pitch mean less or more of something? Pitch and taste, color, and location are substitutive dimensions. Substitute one value for another to make a change. There is no natural concept of more or less in the comparison of different pitches, or hues, or taste qualities. Other natural mappings follow from the principles of perception and allow for the natural grouping or patterning of controls and feedback. See Figure 8. Mapping problems are abundant, one of the fundamental causes of difficulties. Consider the telephone. Suppose you wish to activate the callback on no reply function. To initiate this feature on one telephone system, press and release the recall button, the button on the handset, then dial 60, then dial the number you called. There are several problems here. First, the description of the function is relatively complex, yet incomplete. What if two people set up callback at the same time? What if the person does not come back until a week later? What if you have meanwhile set up three or four other functions? What if you want to cancel it? Second, the action to be performed is arbitrary. Dial 60. Why 60? Why not 73 or 27? How does one remember an arbitrary number? Third, the sequence ends with what appears to be a redundant, unnecessary action, dialing the number of the person to be called. If the phone system is smart enough to do all these other things, why can't it remember the number that was just attempted? Why must it be told all over again? And finally, consider the lack of feedback. How do I know I did the right action? Maybe I disconnected the phone. Maybe I set up some other special feature. There is no visible or audible way to know immediately. A device is easy to use when there is visibility to the set of possible actions, where the controls and displays exploit natural mappings. The principles are simple but rarely incorporated into design. Good design takes care, planning, thought. It takes conscious attention to the needs of the user. And sometimes the designer gets it right. Once, when I was at a conference at Gmunden, Austria, a group of us went off to see the sights. I sat directly behind the driver of the brand new, sleek, high-technology German tour bus. I gazed in wonder at the hundreds of controls scattered all over the front of the bus. How can you ever learn all those controls? I asked the driver, with the aid of a German-speaking colleague. The driver was clearly puzzled by the question. What do you mean? He replied. Each control is just where it ought to be. There is no difficulty. A good principle, that. Controls are where they ought to be. One function, one control. Harder to do, of course, than to say. But essentially, this is the principle of natural mappings. The relationship between controls and actions should be apparent to the user. I return to this topic later in the book, for the problem of determining the naturalness of mappings is difficult but crucial. I've already described how my car's controls are generally easy to use. Actually, the car has lots of problems. The approach to usability used in the car seems to be to make sure that you can reach everything and see everything. That's good, but not nearly good enough. Here's a simple example. The controls for the loudspeakers, a simple control that determines whether the sound comes out of the front speakers, the rear, or a combination. Rotate the wheel from left to right or right to left. Simple. Except how do you know which way to rotate the control? Which direction moves the sound to the rear, which to the front? If you want sound to come out of the front speaker, you should be able to move the control to the front. To get it out of the back, move the control to the back. Then the form of the motion would mimic the function and make a natural mapping. But the way the control is actually mounted in the car, forward and backward get translated into left and right. Which direction is which? There is no natural relationship. What's worse, the control isn't even labeled. Even the instruction manual does not say how to use it. The control should be mounted so that it moves forward and backward. If that can't be done, rotate the control 90 degrees on the panel so that it moves vertically. Moving something up to represent forward is not as natural as moving it forward, but at least it follows a standard convention. In fact, we see that both the car and the telephone have easy functions and difficult ones. The car seems to have more of the easy ones, the telephone more of the difficult ones. Moreover, with the car, enough of the controls are easy that I can do almost everything I need to. Not so with the telephone. It is very difficult to use even a single one of the special features. The easy things on both telephone and car have a lot in common, as do the difficult things. When things are visible, they tend to be easier than when they are not. In addition, there must be a close, natural relationship between the control and its function, a natural mapping. The principle of feedback. Feedback, sending back to the user information about what action has actually been done, what result has been accomplished, is a well-known concept in the science of control and information theory. Imagine trying to talk to someone when you cannot even hear your own voice, or trying to draw a picture with a pencil that leaves no mark. There would be no feedback. In the good old days of the telephone, before the American telephone system was divided among competing companies, before telephones were fancy and had so many features, telephones were designed with much more care and concern for the user. Designers at the Bell Telephone Laboratories worried a lot about feedback. The push buttons were designed to give an appropriate feel, tactile feedback. When a button was pushed, a tone was fed back into the earpiece, so the user could tell that the button had been properly pushed. When the phone call was being connected, clicks, tones, and other noises gave the user feedback about the progress of the call. And the speaker's voice was always fed back to the earpiece in a carefully controlled amount, because the auditory feedback, called side tone, helped the person regulate how loudly to talk. All this has changed. Now we have telephones that are much more powerful and often cheaper than those that existed just a few years ago. More function for less money. To be fair, these new designs are pushing hard on the paradox of technology. Added functionality generally comes along at the price of added complexity. But that does not justify backward progress. Why are the modern telephone systems so difficult to learn and to use? Basically, the problem is that the systems have more features and less feedback. Suppose all telephones had a small display screen, not unlike the ones on small, inexpensive calculators. The display could be used to present upon the push of a button a brief menu of all the features of the telephone, one by one. When the desired one was encountered, the user would push another button to indicate that it should be invoked. If further action was required, the display could tell the person what to do. The display could even be auditory, with speech instead of a visual display. Only two buttons need be added to the telephone, one to change the display, one to accept the option on display. Of course, the telephone would be slightly more expensive. The trade-off is cost versus usability. Pity the poor designer. Designing well is not easy. The manufacturer wants something that can be produced economically. The store wants something that will be attractive to its customers. The purchaser has several demands. In the store, the purchaser focuses on price and appearance, and perhaps on prestige value. At home, the same person will pay more attention to functionality and usability. The repair service cares about maintainability. How easy is the device to take apart, diagnose, and service? The needs of those concerned are different and often conflict. Nonetheless, the designer may be able to satisfy everyone. A simple example of good design is the 3.5-inch magnetic diskette for computers, a small circle of floppy magnetic material encased in hard plastic. Earlier types of floppy disks did not have this plastic case, which protects the magnetic material from abuse and damage. A sliding metal cover protects the delicate magnetic surface when the diskette is not in use and automatically opens when the diskette is inserted into the computer. The diskette has a square shape. There are apparently 8 possible ways to insert it into the machine, only one of which is correct. What happens if I do it wrong? I try inserting the disk sideways. Ah, the designer thought of that. A little study shows that the case really isn't square, it's rectangular. So you can't insert a longer side. I try backward. The diskette goes in only part of the way. Small protrusions, indentations, and cutouts prevent the diskette from being inserted backward or upside down. Of the 8 ways one might try to insert the diskette, only one is correct, and only that one will fit. An excellent design. Take another example of good design. My felt-tipped marking pen has ribs along only one of its sides. Otherwise, all sides look identical. Careful examination shows that the tip of the marker is angled and makes the best line if the marker is held with the ribbed side up, a natural result if the forefinger rests upon the ribs. No harm results if I hold the marker another way, but the marker writes less well. The ribs are a subtle design cue, functional, yet visibly and aesthetically unobtrusive. The world is permeated with small examples of good design, with the amazing details that make important differences in our lives. Each detail was added by some person, a designer, carefully thinking through the uses of the device, the ways that people abuse things, the kinds of errors that can get made, and the functions that people wish to have performed. Then why is it that so many good design ideas don't find their way into products in the marketplace? Or something good shows up for a short time, only to fall into oblivion? I once spoke with a designer about the frustrations of trying to get the best product out. It usually takes 5 or 6 attempts to get a product right. This may be acceptable in an established product, but consider what it means in a new one. Suppose a company wants to make a product that will perhaps make a real difference. The problem is that if the product is truly revolutionary, it is unlikely that anyone will quite know how to design it right the first time. It will take several tries. But if a product is introduced into the marketplace and fails, well, that is it. Perhaps it could be introduced a second time, or maybe even a third time. But after that, it is dead. Everyone believes it to be a failure. I asked him to explain. "You mean," I said, "that it takes 5 or 6 tries to get an idea right?" "Yes," he said, "at least that." "But," I replied, "you also said that if a newly introduced product doesn't catch on in the first 2 or 3 times, then it is dead?" "Yep," he said. "The new products are almost guaranteed to fail, no matter how good the idea." "Now you understand," said the designer. "Consider the use of voice messages on complex devices such as cameras, soft drink machines, and copiers. A failure. No longer even tried." "Too bad. It really is a good idea, for it can be very useful when the hands or eyes are busy elsewhere. But those first few attempts were very badly done and the public scoffed. Properly. Now nobody dares try it again, even in those places where it is needed." The paradox of technology. Technology offers the potential to make life easier and more enjoyable. Each new technology provides increased benefits. At the same time, added complexities arise to increase our difficulty and frustration. The development of a technology tends to follow a U-shaped curve of complexity, starting high, dropping to a low, comfortable level, then climbing again. New kinds of devices are complex and difficult to use. As technicians become more competent and an industry matures, devices become simpler, more reliable, and more powerful. But then, after the industry has stabilized, newcomers figure out how to add increased power and capability, but always at the expense of added complexity and sometimes decreased reliability. We can see the curve of complexity in the history of the watch, radio, telephone, and television set. Take the radio. In the early days, radios were quite complex. To tune in a station required several adjustments, including one for the antenna, one for the radio frequency, one for intermediate frequencies, and controls for both sensitivity and loudness. Later radios were simpler and had controls only to turn it on, tune the station, and adjust the loudness. But the latest radios are again very complex, perhaps even more so than the early ones. Now the radio is called a tuner, and it is littered with numerous controls, switches, slide bars, lights, displays, and meters. The modern sets are technologically superior, offering higher quality sound, better reception, and enhanced capability. But what good is the technology if it is too complex to use? The design problem posed by technological advances is enormous. Consider the watch. A few decades ago, watches were simple. All you had to do was set the time and keep them wound. The standard control was the stem, a knob at the side of the watch. Turning the knob wound the spring that worked the watch. Pulling the knob out and turning it made the hands move. The operations were easy to learn and easy to do. There was a reasonable relation between the turning of the knob and the resulting turning of the hands. The design even took into account human error. The normal position of the stem was for winding the spring, so that an accidental turn would not reset the time. In the modern digital watch, the spring is gone, replaced by a motor run by long-lasting batteries. All that remains is the task of setting the watch. The stem is still a sensible solution, for you can go fast or slow, forward or backward, until the exact desired time is reached. But the stem is more complex, and therefore more expensive, than simple push-button switches. If the only change in the transition from the spring-wound analog watch to the battery-run digital watch were in how the time was set, there would be little difficulty. The problem is that new technology has allowed us to add more functions to the watch. The watch can give the day of the week, the month, and the year. It can act as a stopwatch, which itself has several functions, a countdown timer, and an alarm clock or two. It has the ability to show the time for different time zones. It can act as a counter and even as a calculator. But the added functions cause problems. How do you design a watch that has so many functions while trying to limit the size, cost, and complexity of the device? How many buttons does it take to make the watch workable and learnable, yet not too expensive? There are no easy answers. Whenever the number of functions and required operations exceeds the number of controls, the design becomes arbitrary, unnatural, and complicated. The same technology that simplifies life by providing more functions in each device also complicates life by making the device harder to learn, harder to use. This is the paradox of technology. The paradox of technology should never be used as an excuse for poor design. It is true that as the number of options and capabilities of any device increases, so too must the number and complexity of the controls. But the principles of good design can make complexity manageable. In one of my courses, I gave as homework the assignment to design a multiple-function clock radio. You have been employed by a manufacturing company to design their new product. The company is considering combining the following into one item: AM/FM radio, cassette player, CD player, telephone, telephone answering machine, clock, alarm clock. The alarm can turn on a tone, radio, cassette, or CD. Desk or bed lamp. The company is trying to decide whether to include a small 2-inch screen TV set and a switched electric outlet that can turn on a coffee maker or toaster. Your job is A, to recommend what to build, then B, to design the control panel, and finally C, to certify that it is actually both what customers want and easy to use. State what you would do for the three parts of your job, A, B, and C. Explain how you would go about validating and justifying your recommendations. Draw a rough sketch of a control panel for the items in the indented list, with a brief justification and analysis of the factors that went into the choice of design. There are several things I looked for in the answer. First, how well did the answer address the real needs of the user? I expected my students to visit the homes of potential users to see how their current devices were being used and to determine how the combined multipurpose device would be used. Next, I evaluated whether all the controls were usable and understandable, allowing all the desired functions to be operated with minimum confusion or error. Clock radios are often used in the dark, with the user in bed and reaching overhead to grope for the desired control. Therefore, the unit had to be usable in the dark by feel only. It was not supposed to be possible to make a serious mistake by accidentally hitting the wrong control. Alas, many existing clock radios do not tolerate serious errors. For example, the user may reset the time by hitting the wrong button accidentally. Finally, the design was expected to take into account real issues in cost, manufacturability, and aesthetics. The finished design had to pass muster with users. The point of the exercise was for the student to realize the paradox of technology. Added complexity and difficulty cannot be avoided when functions are added. But with clever design, they can be minimized. Chapter 2. The Psychology of Everyday Things. During my family's stay in England, we rented a furnished house while the owners were away. One day, our landlady returned to the house to get some personal papers. She walked over to her filing cabinet and attempted to open the top drawer. It wouldn't open. She pushed it forward and backward, right and left, up and down, without success. I offered to help. I wiggled the drawer, then I twisted the front panel, pushed down hard and banged the front with the palm of one hand. The cabinet drawer slid open. "Oh," she said, "I'm sorry. I am so bad at mechanical things." Falsely blaming yourself. I have studied people making errors, sometimes serious ones, with mechanical devices, light switches and fuses, computer operating systems and word processors, even airplanes and nuclear power plants. Invariably, people feel guilty and either try to hide the error or blame themselves for stupidity or clumsiness. I often have difficulty getting permission to watch. Nobody likes to be observed performing badly. I point out that the design is faulty and that others make the same errors. Still, if the task appears simple or trivial, then people blame themselves. It is as if they take perverse pride in thinking of themselves as mechanically incompetent. I once was asked by a large computer company to evaluate a brand new product. I spent a day learning to use it and trying it out on various problems. In using the keyboard to enter data, it was necessary to differentiate between the return key and the enter key. If the wrong key was typed, the last few minutes' work was irrevocably lost. I pointed this problem out to the designer, explaining that I myself had made the error frequently, and that my analyses indicated that this was very likely to be a frequent error among users. The designer's first response was, "Why did you make that error? Didn't you read the manual?" He proceeded to explain the different functions of the two keys. "Yes, yes," I explained. "I understand the two keys. I simply confused them. They have similar functions, are located in similar locations on the keyboard, and as a skilled typist, I often hit return automatically without thought. Certainly others have had similar problems." "Nope," said the designer. He claimed that I was the only person who had ever complained, and the company's secretaries had been using the system for many months. I was skeptical. So we went together to some of the secretaries and asked them whether they had ever hit the return key when they should have hit enter. And did they ever lose their work as a result? "Oh, yes," said the secretaries. "We do that a lot." "Well, how come nobody ever said anything about it?" we asked the secretaries. After all, they were encouraged to report all problems with the system. The reason was simple. When the system stopped working or did something strange, the secretaries dutifully reported it as a problem. But when they made the return versus enter error, they blamed themselves. After all, they had been told what to do. They had simply erred. Of course, people do make errors. Complex devices will always require some instruction, and someone using them without instruction should expect to make errors and to be confused. But designers should take special pains to make errors as cost-free as possible. Here is my credo about errors. If an error is possible, someone will make it. The designer must assume that all possible errors will occur and design so as to minimize the chance of the error in the first place, or its effects once it gets made. Errors should be easy to detect, they should have minimal consequences, and if possible, their effects should be reversible. Misconceptions of everyday life. Our lives are filled with misconceptions. This should not be surprising. We must frequently deal with unfamiliar situations. Psychologists love errors and misconceptions, for they give important clues about the organization and operation of our minds. Many everyday misunderstandings are classified as naive or folk understandings. And not just plain folk hold these misconceptions. Aristotle developed an entire theory of physics that physicists find quaint and amusing. Yet Aristotle's theories correspond much better to common sense, everyday observations, than do the highly refined and abstract theories we are taught in school. Aristotle developed what we might call naive physics. It is only when you study the esoteric world of physics that you learn what is correct and are able to understand why the naive view is wrong. Aristotle's naive physics. For example, Aristotle thought that moving objects kept moving if only something kept pushing them. Today's physicist says, nonsense. A moving object continues to move unless some force is exerted to stop it. This is Newton's first law of motion, and it contributed to the development of modern physics. Yet anyone who has ever pushed a heavy box along a street, or for that matter, hiked for miles into the wilderness, knows that Aristotle was right. If you don't keep on pushing, the movement stops. Of course, Newton and his successors assume the absence of friction and air. Aristotle lived in a world where there was always friction and air resistance. Once friction is involved, then objects in motion tend to stop unless you keep pushing. Aristotle's theory may be bad physics, but it describes reasonably well what we can see in the real world. Think about how you might answer the following questions. 1. I take a pistol, and, carefully aiming it on a level horizontal line, I fire a bullet. With my other hand, I hold a bullet, so that the bullet in the pistol and the one in my hand are exactly the same distance from the ground. I drop the bullet at the same instant as I fire the pistol. Which bullet hits the ground first? 2. Imagine someone running across a field carrying a ball. As you watch, the runner drops the ball. Which path, A, B, or C in Figure 9, does the ball take as it falls to the ground? The physicist says the answer to the bullet problem is trivial. Both bullets hit the ground at the same time. The fact that one bullet is traveling horizontally very rapidly has absolutely no effect on how fast it falls downward. Why should we accept that answer? Shouldn't the speeding bullet develop some lift, sort of like an airplane, so that it will stay up a bit longer because it is kept up by the air? Who knows? The theory of physics is based upon a situation where there is no air. The popular misconception is that the pistol bullet will hit the ground long after the dropped bullet. Yet this naive view doesn't seem so strange. In the case of the falling ball, our prediction is that the ball will drop straight down. In fact, the falling ball follows trajectory A, see Figure 9. As it is carried by the runner, it is set into horizontal motion. It then maintains the same forward speed upon being released, even as it also falls to the ground. Naive physics and naive views of psychology and other fields are often sensible, even if wrong. But at times they can get us into trouble. Yet we must have a way to digest the unfamiliar, for people are explanatory creatures. People as explanatory creatures. Mental models, our conceptual models of the way objects work, events take place, or people behave, result from our tendency to form explanations of things. These models are essential in helping us understand our experiences, predict the outcomes of our actions, and handle unexpected occurrences. We base our models on whatever knowledge we have, real or imaginary, naive or sophisticated. Mental models are often constructed from fragmentary evidence, with but a poor understanding of what is happening, and with a kind of naive psychology that postulates causes, mechanisms, and relationships, even where there are none. Some faulty models lead to the frustrations of everyday life, as in the case of my unsettable refrigerator, where my mental model of its operation did not correspond to reality. Far more serious are faulty models of such complex systems as an industrial plant or passenger airplane. Misunderstanding there can lead to devastating accidents. Consider the room thermostat. How does it work? Here is a device that offers almost no evidence of its operation, except in a highly roundabout manner. We walk into a room and we feel too cold, so we walk over to the thermostat and set it higher. Eventually, we feel warmer. Note that the same thing applies to the temperature control for a cooking oven, or a pottery kiln, or an air conditioner, or almost any device whose temperature is to be regulated. Want to bake a cake, but the oven is off? Set the oven thermostat and the oven gets to the desired temperature. Is the room too hot? Set the thermostat on the air conditioner. Fine. But how does the thermostat work? If you are in a cold room, in a hurry to get warm, will the room heat more quickly if you turn the thermostat all the way up? Or if you want the oven to reach its working temperature faster, should you turn the temperature dial all the way to maximum, then turn it down once the desired temperature is reached? Or to cool a room most quickly, should you set the air conditioner thermostat to its lowest temperature setting? If you think that the room or oven will heat or cool faster if the thermostat is turned all the way to the maximum setting, you are wrong. You hold a folk theory of thermostats. There are two commonly held folk theories about thermostats, the timer theory and the valve theory. The timer theory proposes that the thermostat simply controls the relative proportion of time that the device stays on. Set the thermostat midway and the device is on about half the time. Set it all the way up and the device is on all the time. Hence, to heat or cool something most quickly, set the thermostat so that the device is on all the time. The valve theory proposes that the thermostat controls how much heat or cold comes out of the device. Turn the thermostat all the way up and you get maximum heating or cooling. The correct story is that the thermostat is just an on-off switch. It treats the heater, oven, and air conditioner as all-or-nothing devices that can be either fully on or fully off, with no in-between states. The thermostat turns the heater, oven, or air conditioner completely on at full power until the temperature setting on the thermostat is reached. Then it turns the unit completely off. Setting the thermostat at one extreme cannot affect how long it takes to reach the desired temperature. The real point of the example is not that some people have erroneous theories. It is that everyone forms theories, mental models, to explain what they have observed. In the case of the thermostat, the design gives absolutely no hint as to the correct answer. In the absence of external information, people are free to let their imaginations run free, as long as the mental models they develop account for the facts as they perceive them. Blaming the wrong cause. "Look at this," my colleague exclaimed to me. "My computer terminal is broken. The library did it. Every time I connect it to the library catalog, I have trouble. Now I can't even use the terminal to read my computer mail anymore." "That doesn't make sense," I replied. "You can't even turn on the power to the terminal. How could a computer program possibly do that kind of damage?" "All I know," he said, "is that everything was working fine until I tried to look up an author in the library catalog using that new library program. And then my terminal stopped working. I always have trouble with that program, and this is simply too much of a coincidence to be anything else." Well, it was a coincidence. It turns out that the power supply to the terminal had burned out, a fact that had nothing to do with the computer program. Coincidence is enough to set the causal wheels rolling. Earlier, I suggested that people have a tendency to blame themselves for difficulties with technology. Actually, the point is a bit more complicated. People do tend to find causes for events, and just what they assign as the cause varies. In part, people tend to assign a causal relation whenever two things occur in succession. If I do some action A just prior to some result R, then I conclude that A must have caused R, even if, as in the example above, there really was no relationship between the two. The story is more complex when we intend an action to produce a desired result and fail. And there are problems when we have done the action through some intermediate mechanism. Just where do we put the blame for failure? The answer is not clear. The psychology of blame, or to be more accurate, of attribution, is complex and not fully understood. In part, there seems to have been some perceived causal relationship between the thing being blamed and the result. The word perceived is critical. The causal relationship does not have to exist. The person simply has to think it is there. Sometimes we attribute the cause to things that had nothing to do with the action, and sometimes we ignore the real culprit. One major aspect of the assignment of blame is that we frequently have little information on which to make the judgment, and what little we have may be wrong. As a result, blame or credit can be assessed almost independently of reality. Here is where the apparent simplicity of everyday objects causes problems. Suppose I try to use an everyday thing, but I can't. Where is the fault? In my action or in the thing? We are apt to blame ourselves. If we believe that others are able to use the device, and if we believe that it is not very complex, then we conclude that any difficulties must be our own fault. Suppose the fault really lies in the device, so that lots of people have the same problems. Because everyone perceives the fault to be his or her own, nobody wants to admit having trouble. This creates a conspiracy of silence, maintaining the feelings of guilt and helplessness among users. Interestingly enough, the common tendency to blame ourselves for failures with everyday objects goes against the normal attributions people make. In general, it has been found that people attribute their own problems to the environment, those of other people to their personalities. Here is a made-up example. Consider Tom, the office terror. Today, Tom got to work late, slammed the door to his office, and yelled at his colleagues. "Ah," his colleagues and staff said, "there he goes again. He's so excitable, always gets mad at the slightest thing." Now consider Tom's point of view. "I had a really hard day," Tom explains. "I woke up late because when my clock radio turned on, I tried to hit the snooze bar to give me 5 minutes more sleep. Instead, I reset the time so that I overslept for a whole hour. That wasn't my fault. The radio is badly designed. I didn't even have time for my morning coffee. I couldn't find a close parking spot because I was late. And then because I was in such a rush, I dropped my papers all over the street and got them dirty. Then when I went to get a cup of coffee from the office machine, it was all out. None of this was my fault. I had a run of really bad events. Yes, I was a bit curt with my colleagues, but who wouldn't be under the same circumstances? Surely they understand." But Tom's colleagues see a different picture. They don't have access to his inner thoughts or even to his morning's activities. All they see is that Tom yelled at them simply because the office coffee machine was empty. And this reminds them of another time when the same thing happened. He does that all the time, they conclude, always blowing up over the most minor events. The events are the same events, but there are two different points of view and two different interpretations. The protagonist, Tom, views his actions as sensible responses to the trials of life. The onlooker views Tom's actions as a result of his explosive, irascible personality. It seems natural for people to blame their own misfortunes on the environment. It seems equally natural to blame other people's misfortunes on their personalities. Just the opposite attribution, by the way, is made when things go well. When things go right, people credit their own forceful personalities and intelligence. "I really did a good job today. No wonder we finished the project so well." The onlookers do the reverse. When they see things go well for someone else, they credit the environment. "Joan really was lucky today. She just happened to be standing there when the boss came by, so she got all the credit for the project work." Some people have all the luck. In all cases, whether a person is inappropriately accepting blame for the inability to work simple objects, or attributing behavior to environment or personality, a faulty mental model is at work. Learned helplessness. The phenomenon called learned helplessness may help explain the self-blame. It refers to the situation in which people experience failure at a task, often numerous times. As a result, they decide that the task cannot be done, at least not by them. They are helpless. They stop trying. If this feeling covers a group of tasks, the result can be severe difficulties coping with life. In the extreme case, such learned helplessness leads to depression and to a belief that the person cannot cope with everyday life at all. Sometimes all that it takes to get such a feeling of helplessness is a few experiences that accidentally turn out bad. The phenomenon has been most frequently studied as a precursor to the clinical problems of depression, but it might easily arise with a few bad experiences with everyday objects. Taught helplessness. Do the common technology and mathematics phobias result from a kind of learned helplessness? Could a few instances of failure in what appear to be straightforward situations generalize to every technological object, every mathematics problem? Perhaps. In fact, the design of everyday things and the design of mathematics courses seems almost guaranteed to cause this. We could call this phenomenon taught helplessness. With badly designed objects, constructed so as to lead to misunderstanding, faulty mental models, and poor feedback, no wonder people feel guilty when they have trouble using objects, especially when they perceive, even if incorrectly, that nobody else is having the same problems. Or consider the normal mathematics curriculum, which continues relentlessly on its way, each new lesson assuming full knowledge and understanding of all that has passed before. Even though each point may be simple, once you fall behind, it is hard to catch up. The result? Mathematics phobia. Not because the material is difficult, but because it is taught so that difficulty in one stage hinders further progress. The problem is that once failure starts, it soon generalizes by self-blame to all of mathematics. Similar processes are at work with technology. The vicious cycle starts. If you fail at something, you think it is your fault. Therefore, you think you can't do that task. As a result, next time you have to do the task, you believe you can't, so you don't even try. The result is that you can't, just as you thought. You're trapped in a self-fulfilling prophecy. The nature of human thought and explanation. It isn't always easy to tell just where the blame for a problem should be placed. A number of dramatic accidents have come about in part from the false assessment of blame in a situation. Highly skilled, well-trained people are using complex equipment when suddenly something goes wrong. They have to figure out what the problem is. Most industrial equipment is pretty reliable. When the instruments indicate that something is wrong, one has to consider the possibility that the instruments themselves are wrong. Often, this is the correct assessment. But when operators mistakenly blame the instruments for an actual equipment failure, the situation is ripe for a major accident. It is spectacularly easy to find examples of false assessment in industrial accidents. Analysts come in well after the fact, knowing what actually did happen. With hindsight, it is almost impossible to understand how the people involved could have made the mistake. But from the point of view of the person making decisions at the time, the sequence of events is quite natural. At the Three Mile Island nuclear power plant, operators pushed a button to close a valve. The valve had been opened properly to allow excess water to escape from the nuclear core. In fact, the valve was deficient, so it didn't close. But a light on the control panel indicated that the valve position was closed. The light actually didn't monitor the valve, only the electrical signal to the valve, a fact known by the operators. Still, why suspect a problem? The operators did look at the temperature in the pipe leading from the valve. It was high, indicating that fluid was still flowing through the closed valve. Ah, but the operators knew that the valve had been leaky, so the leak would explain the high temperature. But the leak was known to be small, and operators assumed that it wouldn't affect the main operation. They were wrong, and the water that was able to escape from the core added significantly to the problems of that nuclear disaster. I think the operator's assessment was perfectly reasonable. The fault was in the design of the lights and in the equipment that gave false evidence of a closed valve. Similar misinterpretations take place all the time. I have studied a number of airline accidents. Consider the flight crew of the Lockheed L-1011, flying from Miami, Florida to Nassau, Bahamas. The plane was over the Atlantic Ocean, about 110 miles from Miami, when the low oil pressure light for one of the three engines went on. The crew turned off the engine and turned around to go back to Miami. 8 minutes later, the low pressure lights for the remaining two engines also went on, and the instruments showed zero oil pressure and quantity in all three engines. What did the crew do now? They didn't believe it. After all, the pilot correctly said later, the likelihood of simultaneous oil exhaustion in all three engines was one in millions, I would think. At the time, sitting in the airplane, simultaneous failure did seem most unlikely. Even the National Transportation Safety Board declared the analysis of the situation by the flight crew was logical and was what most pilots probably would have done if confronted by the same situation. What happened? The second and third engines were indeed out of oil, and they failed. So there were no operating engines. One had been turned off when its gauge registered low. The other two had failed. The pilots prepared the plane for an emergency landing on the water. The pilots were too busy to instruct the flight crew properly, so the passengers were not prepared. There was semi-hysteria in the passenger cabin. At the last minute, just as the plane was about to ditch in the ocean, the pilots managed to restart the first engine and to land safely at Miami. Then that engine failed at the end of the runway. Why did all three engines fail? Three missing O-rings, one missing from each of three oil plugs, allowed all the oil to seep out. The O-rings were put in by two different people who worked on the three engines, one for the two plugs on the wings, the other for the plug on the tail. How did both workers make the same mistake? Because the normal method by which they got the oil plugs had been changed that day. The whole tale is very instructive, for there were four major failures of different sorts, from the omission of the O-rings, to the inadequacy of the maintenance procedures, to the false assessment of the problem, to the poor handling of the passengers. Fortunately, nobody was injured. The analysts of the National Transportation Safety Board got to write a fascinating report. I've misinterpreted signals, as I'm sure most people have. My family was driving from San Diego to Mammoth, California, a ski area about 500 miles north, a 10 to 12-hour drive. As we drove, we noticed more and more signs advertising the hotels and gambling casinos of Las Vegas, Nevada. Strange, we said. Las Vegas always did advertise a long way off. There is even a billboard in San Diego. But this seems excessive, advertising on the road to Mammoth. We stopped for gasoline and continued on our journey. Only later, when we tried to find a place to eat supper, did we discover that we had taken the wrong turn nearly 2 hours earlier, before we had stopped for gasoline, and that we were on the road to Las Vegas, not the road to Mammoth. We had to backtrack the entire 2-hour segment, wasting 4 hours of driving. It's humorous now. It wasn't then. Find an explanation and we are happy. But our explanations are based on analogy with past experience, experience that may not apply in the current situation. In the Three Mile Island incident, past experience with a leaky valve explained away the discrepant temperature reading. On the flight from Miami to Nassau, the pilot's lack of experience with simultaneous oil pressure failure triggered their belief that the instruments must be faulty. In the driving story, the prevalence of billboards for Las Vegas seemed easily explained. Once we have an explanation, correct or incorrect, for otherwise discrepant or puzzling events, there is no more puzzle, no more discrepancy. As a result, we are complacent, at least for a while. How people do things. The seven stages of action. I am in Italy at a conference. I watch the next speaker attempt to thread a film onto a projector that he has never used before. He puts the reel into place, then takes it off and reverses it. Another person comes to help. Jointly, they thread the film through the projector and hold the free end, discussing how to put it on the take-up reel. Two more people come over to help, and then another. The voices grow louder, in three languages, Italian, German, and English. One person investigates the controls, manipulating each and announcing the result. Confusion mounts. I can no longer observe all that is happening. The conference organizer comes over. After a few moments, he turns and faces the audience, which has been waiting patiently in the auditorium. Ahem, he says. Is anybody expert in projectors? Finally, 14 minutes after the speaker had started to thread the film, and 8 minutes after the scheduled start of the session, a blue-coated technician appears. He scowls, then promptly takes the entire film off the projector, re-threads it, and gets it working. What makes something like threading the projector difficult to do? To answer this question, the central one of this book, we need to know what happens when someone does something. We need to examine the structure of an action. The basic idea is simple. To get something done, you have to start with some notion of what is wanted, the goal that is to be achieved. Then you have to do something to the world, that is, take action to move yourself or manipulate someone or something. Finally, you check to see that your goal was made. So there are four different things to consider: the goal, what is done to the world itself, and the check of the world. The action itself has two major aspects, doing something and checking. Call these execution and evaluation. Figure 10. Real tasks are not quite so simple. The original goal may be imprecisely specified. Perhaps get something to eat, get to work,